Okay, this week's Parsha is Parsha of Vayetze. This is our third time going through Vayetze, and we're tackling the beginning part of the Parsha, which is the episode of the prophecy of the ladder with the angels Olim b'Yordim Bo, rising and falling. And the class was called Parsha of Vayetze. Be like water, my friend, which is taken from none other than Bruce Lee. Let's get a little Eastern inspiration here, guys. Bruce Lee himself. Here we go.
I said, empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless, like water. And you put water into a cup, it becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. The water can flow, or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
Those who can't see the video, we have Bruce Lee playing an expert ping pong player with nunchucks. This is amazing. People against him. He's got one nunchuck. That's ridiculous. He's got a mask right now. Watch this. In a mantra. Watch this. Wow. He's not even there to the edge of a mantra. Throwing matches and igniting them with nunchucks. It's like ridiculous. Okay, so obviously you may wonder why would I be bringing up Bruce Lee in a Parsha class? Because it's not a regular Parsha class.
Yeah.
This is a good Parsha class. Anyways, let's go to our sheet. Okay, so you heard his metaphor. He said, be like water. So like a water, if it's poured into a cup, it becomes a cup. If it's poured into a tea kettle, it becomes a kettle. What is his idea? And this is not just his idea. It's actually part of Taoist thought. It's is part of the various Eastern religions. But let's just, you know, we don't care where knowledge comes from. We, you know, we learn from anybody who has a good idea. What does he, what does he mean? What does it mean, be like what?
To adapt.
Say it again.
To adapt.
To adapt. Okay, expand a little more. What is that? Explain a little more. Whatever situation
you're in, like, you just, you flow with it.
All right, so let's start with his world, which is martial arts. Why is that a very important stance if you are in the world of martial arts? Let's start with that. Why is a helpful metaphor?
Because you fight in one style and somebody else is fighting in another style, so you have to, like, adapt. Like, in terms of martial arts.
Or in other words, instead of, like, saying, this is the way I do this, this is the way I do that, I have a very formal and rigid, and, you know, it tells an issue of rigidity. So that's the idea here, is that he's saying that be adaptive, have sort of a neutral stance, and react to the circumstance befitting the circumstance. Now let's move the question to the next level. Why isn't a person naturally like water?
We naturally kind of like get set in our ways. Like we like routine. And when that routine gets interrupted, you know, it's like a shock to the system kind of, and it takes some time to get used to it.
Right. We don't adapt well. I mean, right now we're on the, we are era of Thanksgiving. And, for many people are going to, revisit their families, which, you know, as it said, people visit their families the minimally acceptable social amount of times to visit them. And Thanksgiving is one of those social obligations to visit mom and dad and grandpa and grandma, you know, aunt and uncle. So that's where you have this typical collision, you know what I mean, where people have a very rigid roles of relationship, right? This is the way we relate to you. The fact that you're 30 doesn't make a difference. We're going to relate to you the same way we did when you were 8. Because that's our modality. And we have a hard time changing. In fact, we're not going to change. So there's a natural rigidity and inability to adapt to a circumstance, you know, and applying it to, let's say, for example, into an evolutionary thought. Those who don't adapt, what happens to species that don't adapt?
They die out.
They perish. So the capacity to have the ability to be flexible and adaptable, whether it be, of course, in Bruce Lee's focus, which he wanted to universalize, not just in the world of fighting, but just encountering the world in general, of adapting to the circumstance. Because let's say, for example, let me give you a simple example. For example, in, you know, Bruce Lee's thought, who was innovated a new style of the martial arts. If he felt that the best approach to deal with a circumstance is to run away, he would immediately run away. He's not locked into, I am the ultimate ninja overlord and I will be the heroic figure even if I'm going to die. No, he will leave. You know, he will run away. He's not, he has nothing emotionally vested that he has to continuously fight. If he can avoid fighting, he will. You know what I'm saying? In other words, it's part of his adaptive being like water mentality that he, does that, you know, that's his mentality. So, and it's very hard, man, as Scott pointed out, we are a creature of habit. We like certain things and we like it the same way. It's like the old shoe. We're not going to get rid of it. We put it on, a little scuffed, but it's darn comfortable, and we love it. We love it. We're not getting rid of that. Even if people start to compliment how they don't like it, mention how they don't like it, we don't care. It's comfortable. The same is true with certain qualities that we all have. We have certain, you know, we have certain ways of doing things. Now, I'm going to, the reason we're I'm bringing this as introduction, we're now at the pivot point of a major major turning point in Yaakov's life. As you know, the end of last week's Parsha, Jacob, based upon the advice of his mother, dresses up, impersonates his brother Esav, and quote unquote steals Esav's blessing. Now, how one can steal a blessing and how that did that, it's that's a class in its own right. And I do have class on that on yutorah.org. Use their search function and you'll find it. So now Esav's, does anybody know what was Esav's reaction to Yaakov's stealing of his blessing?
He was angry.
To what degree?
He wants to kill him.
Yes, he wants to kill his own brother, which obviously on the angerometer, a full 10. What happens next? Who recalls the last bit of the Parsha? Anybody know? Anybody know? I'll tell you. So Rebecca, Rivka, his mother, overhears it, figures it out, and is afraid that she's going to lose both sons. They're going to get into a fight, you know, and she might lose both kids on the same day. So she tells Yaakov that he is to go to her brother, Lavan, until Esav cools down. She also frames it to her husband, Isaac, Yitzchak, and that she is sick and tired of these idolatrous wives, the two idolatrous wives that Esav married, which was, and it says, if Yaakov's going to bring home another idolatrous wife into our house, into our lives, I just can't bear it. So he should go to my family and marry a wife. And that's how she sells how Yaakov basically has to, like a bat out of hell, run out of the house. Because he's got, you know, this is something he's got to zip out of town and go to Uncle Lavan and find a wife from the family. So Yaakov goes rather rapidly and seemingly with not too many things out of the house, okay? Now, Yitzchak does not know that he knows that Esav is upset, but he doesn't know that he's willing to kill him. So Yaakov leaves. And that takes us to the intro to the Parsha. So let's have somebody read the beginning part of the Parsha. We'll do a little reading tonight. Who could read it for the benefit who are on who do not have the video and all right. So Suzanne, Bavakasha, read us the story.
Left Beersheba and headed toward Haran, and yeah, came to a familiar place and spent the night there because the sun had already set. Taking some stones, he placed them at his head and lay down to sleep there. He had a vision in a dream. A ladder was standing on the ground, and its top reached up toward heaven. God's angels were going up and down on it. Suddenly, he saw God standing over him. God said, "I am God, Lord of Abraham, your father, and Lord of Yitzhak. I will give to you and your descendants the land upon which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread out to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. All the families on earth will be blessed through you and your descendants. I am with you. I will protect you wherever you go and bring you back to this soil. I will not turn aside from you until I have fully kept this promise to you." Yaakov awoke from his sleep. "God is truly in this place," he said, "but I did not know it." He was frightened. "How awe-inspiring this place is," he exclaimed. "It must be God's temple. It is the gate to heaven." Yaakov got up early in the morning and took the stone that he had placed under his head. He stood it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He named the place God's Temple, Bethel. The town's original name, however, had been Luz. Yaakov made a vow. "If God will be with me," he said, "if he will protect me on the journey that I'm taking, if he gives me bread to eat and clothing to wear, and if I return in peace to my father's house, and I will dedicate myself totally to God. Let this stone that I have set up as a pillar become a temple to God. Of all that you give me, I will set aside a tenth to you."
Okay. All right, so this is a, let me just summarize it. So basically, Yaakov's heading out of town from Beer Sheva, heading north to modern day Aram, you know, Haran, probably Syria. He's trekking northwest, northeast rather. He comes to a place. He spends the night there because the sun had set. He took some stones, rather not so comfy sleeping environment. And then he has a dream, and the famous dream, where there's a ladder on the ground reaching his heaven toward the heaven, and the angels of God are going up and down. And then he saw God, obviously in the dream, standing over him. And God says, he says them 3 points. One, I'll give you the land. Two, your descendants will be as numerous as the dust of the earth, and all the families will be blessed because of you. Three. And four, I'll protect you until you return. Okay. Then Yaakov wakes up, says, "Oh, this is must be a special place. God's in this place." And then apparently he goes back to bed and he gets up in the morning, which is a kind of a weird thing, okay? He takes one of the large stones, he makes into a, stands it up as a pillar, pours oil on it, dedicates it as the Beit El, God's temple, or the house of God, literally. And he makes a vow, "If Hashem will be with me, protects me, give me food to eat, clothing to wear, and I return, then he'll be a God to me," or I'll be, you know, they translate as dedicate totally to God, okay? And this will be place set up as a temple to God, and if you give me, I'll set aside a tenth to you. He'll give Meiser, the 10% a tithe. All right. There's a lot of stuff here. I'm going to raise some questions, which I'm actually not going to answer because it'll be literally multiple classes. Okay, but I want to focus on a couple of things. Number one, what was Yaakov's state of mind as he's running to Haran? Let's see if we can step into Yaakov's mindset. Dad.
Wasn't he scared that his brother was going to run after him and kill him?
Number one, he's afraid that he might get killed, even if he's going to Haran. Number one. What else?
He might not ever be able to come home.
Yes, the whole future, you know, when you have a person who wants to kill you, and the fact that you're moving to another country, you're not sure that you can get back. And in fact, you know, his mom says, you know, go there for a little bit till he cools down, and I'll send somebody to come bring you back. He ends up staying there for 20 years. He does not know that now. Okay? So that's number one. So he knows I'm never going to come back home. What else?
He's worried about daily necessities like eating and having clothes to wear. He doesn't really know where his next meal is going to come from, or
right, because he basically
those basic human things.
Right, so apparently he left his home probably not to be detected, he slipped out of the house, you know, basically with a walking stick and a backpack of basic, you know, a little bit of necessities. And he's off to his, he's really got no economic support. Now, let me ask you a simple question. Going back to last week's class, what happened to his father, Yitzchak, when he moved to Gerar in Beer Sheva?
He became successful.
How successful?
Richer than the king.
Richer than the king. So here we have Yaakov, who in the beginning of last week's parsha is described as Yoshev Ohalim, a person who dwells in tents, which means, according to Unkelus, he's in a house of study. He's basically being supported in learning. He's living a life of luxury. He is the child of a famous and well-respected and successful father. And now what happens to him? What does that do to his state of mind? He goes from absolute luxury to not sure, as Dan said, not knowing when he's going to get his next meal, or having a economic situation which is uncertain at best and horrible at worst. Okay, he's afraid that he will get killed by his brother. That's number two. Number three, he's not sure if he's ever going to be able to return home. So it's a very difficult situation, and you got to go get married. Is that a good platform or circumstance to get married?
No,
not really.
No job, no money, and no family support.
Does he know anything about where he's going to? Does he know about his uncle or the place?
He knows whatever his mom told him about his brother, but again, these are, you know, at this time, even though maybe only a 300-mile journey, but in that day, in that time, you know, back in that time, you know, that was people did not regularly, unless you were a traveling trader, you typically did not take those kind of journeys. You remained pretty, in your general vicinity of maybe, you know, in a certain, within a 10-mile, kilometer, circumference of area. I mean, so it was much more, people didn't move as much. This is a big deal. There's no evidence that he ever met his Uncle Lavan before. He didn't know the family other than he is of the family. Okay?
How come Rivka, his mother, didn't like send him along with like clothing and like food and things like that?
So that of course is a grand debate among the Mefarshim. I think the most simple answer is that he's nervous about his brother, so he sort of slips out of the house he didn't want to like load up 10 camels filled with goodies. Because he knows that his brother is enraged about him, and then he's gonna, oh, so let me get this straight. You're gonna go, you're gonna go get married to a beloved, somebody that my parents want, and you're taking all this great wealth with you. I don't think that would be a wise move on his part. So he took a minimalistic amount of stuff. That's the plain shot. Rashi brings a midrash. I'm not going to go into that because that's an interesting take about that. I'm going with a pshat reason. He did it. He didn't take a lot out of the house because doing so, if he made a big deal, it would cause the wrath of Esav, his brother, and that's the position of the Rashbam. That's Rashi's grandson. It's a pshat-based answer. Okay? Now, let's draw it over here. So what is amazing about that, knowing that's in his head, the first night on his journey, he gets this prophecy. Tell me why that's amazing.
So, it's amazing because he feels like he's alone and he feels like he's scared and he feels like there's no hope. And then Hashem comes through. And he's clearly wrestling with some sort of internal conflict, and it somehow is resolved.
So that is true. He is now. Most people, if you are completely depressed, filled with anxiety, number one, you're not going to be able to sleep at all. It's number one.
Yeah, actually, you're right.
Number one. And number two is, if you're going to have a dream, it's going to be a nightmare. And if you're going to have, but to have a prophecy, that is remarkable. And I want to really, we're going to go here into a principle. We're going to explore some of the foundational principles of prophecy from the perspective of Judaism. As we'll see, Judaism does not maintain the idea that prophecy is suddenly out of nowhere, God starts talking to you. If that starts to happen, that means you're having a psychotic break. Need to get medical attention immediately. That is not the concept of prophecy. So we're going to read a little bit of the Rambam, a little taste of Rambam, who gives sort of the depiction of what is based upon from the Talmud and gathered from various sources of some of the elements of prophecy. So who would like to read?
Again.
All right, Sean, read.
It is one of the foundations of our faith that Hashem conveys prophecy to man. Prophecy is bestowed only upon a very wise sage of a strong character who is never overcome by his natural inclinations in any regard. Instead, with his mind, he overcomes his natural inclinations at all times.
I stop right there. Okay. We are now, with that requirement, we have basically removed 99.9999% of all people. The bar for prophecy is which is in the Jewish concept is really a phenomena of a extremely great person. Doesn't have to be Jewish, has to be a great person. What are the qualities? They have, obviously, they're a great mind, a great intellect. They have great midot, character traits, and they're not overcome by their natural inclinations. Okay? In other words, rather, they're in control. They are not controlled. They are in control. Now, anybody, that means that they're not going to get angry. Oh, they might show anger, but they're not going to get angry. Now, the Rambam actually in another place says actually a prophet can have like one bad quality. You know what I mean? Because later on Yaakov gets afraid when he has the encounter with, he gets overly afraid with his encounter with Esau. Anyway, but basically the person is thoughtful and never says or does any action which is not something which is determined to be the intelligent thing to do. Okay? Not only that, let's go on. The prerequisites continue.
He must also possess a very broad and accurate mental capacity.
All right, so he's a person who has got a rich imagination, tremendous insight, creative. It's unbelievable. Go on.
A person who is full of all of these qualities and is physically sound is fit for prophecy.
So not only that, he has to be healthy. He can't be sick.
When he enters the pardes.
Okay, stop. Who knows what the word pardes refers to?
This is like orchard?
It is an orchard, but it's not a physical orchard.
Isn't yeshiva in Israel?
It is a name of yeshiva in Israel, but that's not what we're talking about here. They took it from here, but that's not what it is. They took that from here. What is pardes? Anybody know? This is for 500 points in the square. Pardes is the orchard. It's a metaphor. It's not a physical place. It is the place where the most where the secrets of the Torah are. Profound, deep secrets, ideas about God, metaphysical ideas, okay? So when he goes into the pardes, he is not physically journeying anywhere. He's exploring certain ideas. Go on.
Okay. So when he enters the Pardes and is drawn into these great and sublime concepts, if he possesses an accurate mental capacity to comprehend and grasp them, he will become holy. He will advance and separate himself from the masses who proceed in the darkness of the time. He must continue and diligently train himself not to have any thoughts whatsoever about fruitless things or the vanities and intrigues of the times.
He's a person who thinks about Hashem all the time and on a very deep level. And he trains himself to not get distracted on, like, he ain't watching a lot of TV. Zero. Okay? He's not schmoozing. He's living in the, you know, the big picture ideas all the time. That's it. That's why people don't like to hang out with him. If you see, the prophets are not so popular. In fact, just a little story, the prophet Elisha, that's Elijah's disciple. So there's a woman called Isha HaShunamit, the Shunammite woman. And the husband says, "Where are you going?" "I'm going to the prophet." So he says, "Why are you going to the prophet? It's not Shabbat. It's not Yontif. It's not Rosh Chodesh." So apparently there was a custom where they go to the prophet's class, the shir. But they looked at that as like, we go when we have to go. But we ain't going any, you know, because it was just too much. It's like too intense. You know what I'm saying? This kind of guy is not the guy you invite for your party, okay? You know what I'm saying? He's super serious about the, you know, about the big issues. Go on.
Instead, his mind should constantly be directed upward, bound beneath Hashem's throne of glory, striving to comprehend the holy and pure forms and gazing at the wisdom of the Holy One, blessed be he, in its entirety, in its manifold manifestations, from the most elevated spiritual form until the navel of the earth, appreciating his greatness from them. After these preparations, the divine spirit will immediately rest upon him.
So again, obviously since I and everybody else, we're not prophets, we don't really understand this in reality, but apparently once he has a systematic sense of the whole, of how Hashem's wisdom governs the world in some sort of manner, nevuah, prophecy, is an automatic thing. Interestingly enough, Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, also maintained that prophecy is an automatic phenomenon. The only difference between Aristotle's notion about prophecy and the Torah's notion is that God can, even if a person's at a certain level, can cancel it, can stop it.
Okay? I have a question. Should I hold it till the end?
Yeah, hold it till the end. We're going to get to that. So automatically, once he's thinking about these things, and again, I don't really understand what all these things are, but it's in the realm of Hashem and how he governs the world in a very abstract way, the divine spirit rests upon him. Okay, go on.
When the spirit rests upon him, his soul becomes intermingled with the angels called Ishim, and he will be transformed into a different person and will understand with a knowledge different from what it was previously. He will rise above the level of other wise men, as the prophet Samuel told Saul, "The spirit of Hashem will descend upon you, and you shall prophesize with them, and you'll be transformed into a different person."
So the key point here is that the prophet is a kind of wise person who has a certain insight that changes his vision of everything always. You know what I'm saying? By in our own lives, just take it down, many, many steps. Sometimes you get a profound insight, that not only explains a particular problem, but you see everything in your life in a new way. That what the Rambam says, that the Navi, the prophet, becomes what they call Ish Acher, a different person. He can't see the world as he did before he became a prophet. Okay? In other words, there's a certain vision of seeing the world sort of as it really is that doesn't allow you to go back and to live in a smaller world. You know what I'm saying? He's stuck on the big picture world and he's differentiated. Okay, we call him Ish Acher, a different person. That applies to men or women, Jew or non-Jew, if they hit this threshold, okay? But it's a kind of wisdom. All right, let's go to halacha number 3. We're skipping the second halacha. Getting to our back to our parsha. Let's go to it.
All right, when a prophet is informed of a message in a vision, it is granted to him in metaphoric imagery. Immediately, the interpretation of the imagery is imprinted upon his heart, and he knows its meaning. For example, the ladder with the angels ascending and descending, envisioned by the patriarch Jacob, was an allegory for the empires and their subjugation of his descendants.
Stop right there. So this is a very important point. All prophets, again, except for Moshe, get the Nevuah in this way. How does it work? They will get an image in their mind, okay? The image that Yaakov got was what? There's a ladder from the ground to the heaven. There are these angelic figures going up and going down. And on top of the ladder is God, and then he says what he says, okay? But what is it, but the question is, the $64,000 question, which is, what is the imagery of the angels going up and then going down? So the Rambam asserts that the imagery, this is from the Midrash, and apparently it was obvious to Avram, to Yaakov, was that the angels refer to what? All the empires that will do what? Which will conquer and dominate the Jewish people. They will rise, but ultimately what will happen to them? They will fall. You have the Babylonian Empire, number one. You have the Persian Empire, number two. You have the Greek Empire, number three. And now we're still in the fourth, which is the Rome, and by extension, the Western world, you know, Christianity, etc., which have are involved in the subjugation of the Jewish people. He saw that. Okay, we're going to get to that. So let's read on a little more. We'll finish this off. We'll ask a couple more exploratory questions. Go ahead.
Similarly, the creatures Ezekiel saw, the boiling pot and the rod from an almond tree, envisioned by Jeremiah, the scroll Ezekiel saw, and the measure seen by Zechariah were all metaphoric images. This is also true with regard to the other prophets. Some would relate the allegory and its explanation as these did. Others would relate only the explanation. At times, they would relate only the imagery without explaining it, as can be seen in some of the prophecies of Ezekiel and Zechariah. All of these prophecies come in the form of metaphoric imagery and allegories.
Okay, so you see you get three options. Option number one is you can have an image and interpretation. Sometimes you can have interpretation and the Navi does not relate, or we don't get the image. And sometimes you get, the most cryptic is you just get an image and there is no interpretation. And that's found in the prophets of Ezekiel and Zechariah. Zechariah has a number of amazing images talking about the end of days. Okay. All right. So let me get some questions here. Now, after understanding the Rambam's requirement of a person to receive a prophecy, what makes Yaakov's experience so unique?
Hmm.
What makes Yaakov's experience so unique? After learning what we learned about from the Rama about the laws, about the ideas of prophecy and how one receives it.
I feel like it was like, it wasn't metaphoric. Like Yaakov's prophecy was like real in many senses because he was wrestling with like so many things. Like I feel like other prophecies that we learn about are more like metaphors and more.
Well, we know it is a metaphor. There is not actually a ladder that goes from the earth to heaven, wherever that is. And there are not angels.
Obviously, it's more like, it's representing his ability to like rise above and so forth. Whereas I feel like other prophecies for like the ends of days are more literal in different parts that we read about, like in Ezekiel, and we read about. I feel like this is like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just not explaining myself.
Anybody else want to jump on this? What is unique about? And I think there are a number of things. But after reading the Rambam's, what's called prerequisites for prophecy, what makes this amazing?
I mean, Yaakov's not exactly a strong character or able to overcome his natural inclinations. I mean, he kind of gets manipulated by his mom, and he's generally being pushed around by other forces within his family.
But neither of the other people that see prophecy
you're raising a question. You're saying it appears that Yaakov does not seem to have the prerequisites for prophecy, to have a prophecy.
Right.
You're saying that really he's being victimized.
Right.
Okay, I like the question. Anyone want to jump in on that? Yeah.
Well, I was going to add, like, kind of piece of evidence for that is even I think in verses like 20 and 21, where even after having the prophecy, it seems like he doesn't like totally dedicate to Hashem because he makes a vow. He's making like a deal with Hashem, like if you give me the clothing to wear and return me in peace, then I'll dedicate myself totally to God. You would think that to be a prophet, you should already be dedicated to God to begin with.
Excellent. I was waiting for somebody there. So one of there's a couple strange things about this. This is why, this is actually, as you can see already, a very it seems like this is a classic example where the story on the surface seems very simplistic. Yaakov goes to sleep, has a dream about a ladder with the angels. God tells him what's going to be, and good to go. No, this is a very problematic episode. Number one, what's the deal with Yaakov making a deal with God? Is he? I mean, if he's a prophet, doesn't he trust God? And God just says, "I'm going to take care of you." So why is he making an appropriate? Why is he saying, "Well, if you do it, I will dedicate myself to you, Hashem, exclusively." A and B. Not only that, I will give 10%. Either giving 10% is a virtue, or it's not a virtue. If it is a virtue, should be regardless of what he's getting in the deal. Right? Is that your question, Sean?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay. That, by the way, is the conversation of all the Rishonim. If you look at the Mikros Gedolos, Rashi, and the Ibn Ezra, and the Rambag, and the Ramban, they're all over that. But again, that's a shear in its own right. That's number one. And we don't see Avram Yitzchak making a neder. And I'll ask another question. Yitzchak had a bunch of nevuot, we saw in last parsha. No imagery. No, it didn't state the imagery. Why does he get the ladder image? And then going back to Dan Lastman's question is, why is Yaakov such a noble figure that he's really worthy of the Maimonidean standard of prophecy? In other words, that's the question. So, well, clearly the Rambam says it because he uses the Rambam, he uses this example as the quintessential example of prophecy, where you get both the image and the interpretation. So he's looking this up. So he's taking a stance that, so he has to learn that, that for example, when Rivka, based, now this goes to another class, based upon her prophecy at the beginning of the Parsha, that she's not just having two kids, she gave birth to two civilizations. And not just two civilizations, but two civilizations that have a yin-yang, seesaw kind of relationship. When one will be up, the other will be down. Conversely, the other one will be up, the other one will be down. And she felt that in order to allow the destiny to be properly directed, she directs Yaakov to do this whole ruse. Now, Yaakov, you, if you take that stance, it's not simply being manipulated into doing this. You have to say, is agreeing to this. Now, the question is, even if you assume that Rivka's vision of the future is the correct one, was this the only way to deliver the end result? Okay? So that's the question. But I wanted to bring up the point here is that what the Rambam is assuming is that Yaakov, even if you want to say that Yaakov is this great, wise person who is perfected in their qualities or most of their qualities and is, you know, constantly thinking about Hashem, this is not a good night for him. This is his first night from running away from home, running away from his life of luxury to poverty, running away from his seemingly near psychotic brother who wants to kill him. You know, he could take a night off here. You know what I'm saying? Yet. So here you see already, going back to our Bruce Lee metaphor, Yaakov, despite being brought up in such a privileged circumstance, you see already has transitioned, like water, to a new reality. And he's not crawling up into a fetal position. And he's not completely crushed. He's not. He's obviously diminished. He's not crushed. And he's still, what? At a certain level of awareness, sensitivity, openness to receive a life-changing and, by extension, world-changing prophecy. In other words, he did not get defeated. One thing you see about Yaakov through their whole life, and he gets nailed with many, many setbacks. He's like water. He's able to regroup, and he's able to function. And he was able to receive a world-class prophecy, even though he's in a diminished state, or not his best state, or seemingly not his best state. Now, we often think that a life of quiet and solitude will bring out the best in us. But invariably, when do people grow the most?
When they face challenges.
Correct, Amanda. Yes, when they face challenges. When they're forced to be out of their comfort zone. Yaakov becomes Yaakov, ironically, not by living in the life of luxury with his saintly father Yitzchak, but when he has to go out in the world and confront both Lavan and then Esav, then the people of Shechem, then a famine, then the rape of his daughter, then the abduction of his son Yosef, who thought killed, then the migrating down to Egypt, then and the whole episode, which is the rest of the book of Bereshit.
Right, but I think that's what makes him worthy of the prophecy. So he may have not been worthy of the prophecy at the time he received the prophecy, but Hashem saw the potential in Yaakov, and that's what made him worthy. Because
I'm arguing that based upon the Rambam, at least you know, based on his stance on prophecy, is that it's not a prophecy is not a gift. Prophecy is a natural phenomena when a person hits a certain threshold. we're seeing that, like Bruce Lee's statement, like water, Yaakov's personal development was that even despite having tremendous setbacks, is able to be open to this particular place seems to be more, which is another interesting thing. What does it mean for a place to be more ready for a spiritual idea or insight? That's another strange thing. He said, "This is, I did not know this was like the, you know, the house of God. This is the gate of heaven." In other words, he calls it, there's something very special about that place. But he's able to, even in his diminished state, he's able to react and take in on it. And I guarantee you, there are hundreds of people that had slept in that exact location before him. And there were hundreds of people that slept in the exact place later, but did not get that prophecy. It shows the stance of Yaakov. Now, what does that help us? The point of the matter is that in life, we are all oftentimes confronted with many, many challenges. And and oftentimes most people defeat themselves in dealing with a circumstance versus being more open, getting to a neutral stance, being open to different ideas, being open to learn from the situation, being like water, not being rigid, allowing the situation. Let me give you a couple examples that I'm sort of dealing with sort of the general MG community. I'll give you an example. So as you know, I try to set people up. And I use the word, I'm going to underline the word try, because it's very difficult. Maybe I just don't have the knack. So I have a situation where I set up a guy with a girl, and they, you know, and I always make the rule. I said, you know, what's it gone to, you know, I sold each person on the thing. I felt that this was a reasonable, you know, in the same zip code, legitimate, worth a try. You know what I'm saying? That's all I can do. So they hit, or calling, emailing, this one was busy, that one was busy. And the person got one side got frustrated with that. Said, I don't want to go out anymore because I don't know, maybe there was a text the person didn't respond to quick enough. And the person says, that person's not my beshert. That's it. Okay. So now I got to go. And it said, the girl and the guy are over 35. Okay. To get high quality people when you're in your 30s is not a given. It's hard. So maybe he or her, I'm not going to say who was, maybe they were not 100% responsive. Let's say they did that sin. Okay. But meanwhile, this person believes that their vision is that the person who they are going to marry is going to flow like water. I'm going to, you know, person A is going to make the call. The other person is going to be there to pick up the phone call. They're going to have a couple of, you know, some fantastic banter on the phone. There'll be a symphony of music swelling in the background. They'll be able to calendar right away. It'll work out perfect. It'll be perfect weather. They'll show up. Nobody will be late. It won't be this. You know, there'll be soft lighting. Everybody will be looking fantastic. They'll look meaningfully to their eyes and say, Mike is shared. No, it's going to suck. Okay? You're going to leave a message. You're going to text. This person works. Going to be going out of town. This person's going to be a little annoying. That's going to be a person annoying. Nobody's going to get knocked off your feet. And then whatever. And if it does work out, it's going to be ups and downs. And this person's going to be a little bit stubborn, this person, about this. And it's going to be a back and forth. And it's going to be a little difficult. And it's not going to be, ain't no Disney going to be happening. Okay? Hey. You know, when you're younger, when you're like dating, when you're like, you know, in the Orthodox world, when you're 20, 21, 22, it's much easier because the person is there's a lot less firm protocols. The person is,
they're more like water.
They are like, thank you, Dan. They are like water. You want to go out? Okay. for, you know, first of all, they're maybe in college or in graduate school. They don't have like, now, let me look at my calendar there. I have precisely 46 minutes on Sunday afternoon. We can have a cup of coffee. Nothing neat. You know what I mean? Like whatever the nuttiness is, okay? So this, I got to go back and try to resell the other person, because I think the person's making a big mistake by saying, like, the person has this fantasy that their beshert will be like, you know, just, it will come like water. No, it's not going to come like water. You have to be like water. It's going to be not work. It's going to be difficult. That's it. That's situation number one. I have a situation number two. This is my life, okay? Number two, person is working in a field, and I'm not going to mention the industry, and the person knows that in this industry, in this company, they're going to have 200 layoffs. That person knows. They don't know they're going to be 200. So I'm saying to the person, look, I'm sure you're fantastic. I know nothing about your industry, but I think you got to start working your Jewish network. You live in a Jewish community. One of the best things about being in the Jewish community is the idea of chesed. People do help other people. It's phenomenal. And the truth is, we're dealing in a world where there is about 4% unemployment, and 60% of jobs come from personal networking referral. I said, you can't, don't wait till you're going to get nailed. You need to start looking for a gig now. And well, then the person's like, and the particular industry, it's an industry that's going on a tremendous, because of technology, tremendous transformation. You have to be open to consider that you'll go into a different industry, because you are a hardworking, conscientious person. You're principled, you're honest, you're loyal. These are traits and qualities that exist in all fields. You got to be open to consider making the move. I was on the phone for 25 minutes. I don't know if I don't know if I made an impact or not. I don't know. So I'm giving you two examples, a world of career and thinking, you know, of the person's ability to be flexible like water, to be open to, in other words, be open to receive new ideas, new experiences, new opportunities, new insights. Yaakov, who's pretty much having a rough day at the office here, bigly, is able to receive, you know, and I'm not answering all the questions, but a prophecy that's recorded in the Torah that we are learning it 4,000 years after its experience. It has a universal idea. And I just think that by the idea of the Bruce Lee's idea of being like water is something which has a flexibility and accepting that I don't control reality. Hashem controls reality. I live in Hashem's world. I don't live my own world. I try to work within his world and try to find the blessing that is woven in there. And a good stance is to have a stance to be like water, not to get hung up and to be, you know, fully neurotic and anxious and upset and this and that, because it's self-defeating. It's self-defeating. I want to end with a little statement from the Radak, Radak's comment on the Parsha here, on this particular episode. Who would like to close us out here tonight? Let's have Suzanne take us home.
Since Yaakov was fleeing from his home and no doubt his mental and spiritual equilibrium had been traumatized somewhat by recent events, God showed him these insights to not only repair the damage, but to provide him with knowledge he had not yet possessed previously. He promised to give him the land that he was presently running away from and reassured him that it was well within the supreme power, the Lord, to accomplish all this when the time would be ripe. He reassured him that he, Yaakov, indeed was Yitzhak's real descendant, and that all the promises made to Abraham would bear fruition through him and his descendants.
So the reason why God did not wait for a more propitious time was really this was the insight that Avram, that Yaakov needed. He's in a tremendous point of complete, at a crossroads in life. He does not know what's going to happen. Hashem comes and gives him this prophecy, even though that, as he says, has been traumatized somewhat by recent events. But he shares him the idea that it's going to be all right. And Yaakov was in a position to able to be open to that and to receive that. And that really is something that it doesn't, life does not always come, you know, on a silver platter. Everything is, tied up with a bow and everything's great. It's rough. And we got to.
What about when real tragedy strikes? Like, you know what I'm saying? When someone's really sick or like, you know, things like that. Like, it's like one thing, like shidduchim, jobs, like these things like happen, you know? But like, what about like stuff like that? You know, we see that all the time.
So again, Yaakov is a good example of that. You know, where his beloved wife dies on him. His daughter gets raped. His son, he thought was killed for 22 years. He had real sorrows. His kids get tossed into jail. You know, when he doesn't know that the viceroy is really Yosef, he just thinks that they're just abducting his kids. He had every kind of, he had a famine. He had real sorrows. And it's not easy. But that's a larger topic, but in a certain sense, the being centered and rolling with it when you're having difficulty is really the best strategy, because it allows you to think of ways to better the situation, improve the situation to the extent that it can be improved, and allow the person to sort of maintain a certain, openness for, you know, positivity, because the truth is there's one thing, there's the reality out there, which you cannot change. But what you can change is how we look at it and how we frame it. And that makes a world of difference. And a book that really discusses this topic in at great length is Viktor Frankl, the great psychologist who went through concentration camps, and his book In Search of Meaning. And basically what he said was that we have Jews here who are being beaten, who see their own kids and family killed in front of their eyes. How are they lasting? So his point was, one of his ideas was that the idea that gives a person strength to go on in the worst of situation is a sense of purpose and meaning in life. What is my life all about? And if my meaning will transcend my circumstance, I will manage and support and be the best person I can be in this given circumstance, and not allow the situation to snuff every goodness of my life out. Because there's always, with the bad, there's always good. And with the good, there's always bad. And if that's really a tremendous mussar, and the truth is, Yaakov when he lost Yosef and he thought he was killed, it says that he, for 22 years, he did not have prophecy. Why?
He was too upset.
He was too depressed. Because a prophet has to be in a good state of mind. That he could not overcome that. He was crushed. He was defeated. But he came out of it. One possibility is because if he knew for sure that Yosef had died, he'd be able to have closure. But there was always an element of that. The story did not perfectly work out. That maybe there's a chance he might be alive.
And yeah, you see that with missing children all the time.
Right. So the fact that there was a possibility that he could return sort of locked him in a state of absolute agony and anxiety. And that would did not allow him to have any prophecy for 22 years. You know, so the answer is you're going to, you're going to get knocked down to the mat, But the art here is to be able to pull yourself up. I mean, you're not going to be a perfect thing that every single day is going to be fantastic, and there's going to be good days and the bad days. But what we model from Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, who had tremendous challenges, they were able to get off the mat, and they were to navigate a very difficult circumstance. And one of the elements, there's more things, but the one idea I wanted to share tonight was sort of the stance that Bruce Lee eloquently expressed, is be like water, my friend.
So beautiful.
All right, guys, have a good night. And a happy Thanksgiving to one and all.
Thank you, Rabbi. Great class.
Thank you, Rabbi. Have a good one.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Take care, guys. You are. Bye.